Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jane Ganahl, co-director of the Lidquake Literary Festival and author of Naked on the Page, The Misadventures of My Unmarried Midlife, and your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Mireille Gugliano, author of the bestseller French Women Don't Get Fat, whose new book is Women, Work, and the Art of Savoir-Faire. I met Mireille about 4 years ago now as a journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I interviewed her over lunch at Campton Place. In fact, it was not supposed to be a lunch interview, but it turned into that because when I got there, she said, "I need to eat lunch. Would you like to eat with me?" And who's going to turn that down? Within the course of this very long lunch, I came to realize several things. One was that everything she wrote in her book about French women not getting fat was absolutely true, because I've never seen such a tiny person eat so much in my life. And also I learned what an incredibly gracious, mentoring, fantastic woman she is. She's been involved in women in business her entire life, her whole career. She's been called a champion of women in business, and I'm also proud to call her my friend. Please welcome Mireille Gugliano.
Merci, Jane. Bonsoir. I had forgotten the similarities of two of my favorite cities, Paris and San Francisco. What is that great song? Oh, I love it. Today, actually, I had a break. I had my beach time. And so what did I do? I visited my favorite bakery for the best cannelé and the best mini palmier. Remember? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it was up and down hills for quite a few hours to get my peasant legs into shape. All this with sun and blue sky. What a treat. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here, and any excuse to come back to San Francisco, I'll just grab it. Of course, tonight I was invited to talk about business, and I will, but I want to start with a general theme that is expressed in my first two books, and certainly is included in Women, Work, and the Art of Savoir-Faire. Okay, ready for a little French lesson? And a phrase that embodies what I believe is an overridingly important theme for women and life. Bien dans sa peau. I repeat, those of you know it, right? Bien dans sa peau, which means being comfortable within one's skin. It's a holistic concept and is no more evident than in what we eat. As the great gastronome and philosopher Bria Saint-Varin said, we are what we eat. I know, today, what and how we eat is a challenge with all the 21st century traps of work, time, stress, prepared foods, junk food. The what, when, where, why, how, and how much we eat. We're talking about lifestyle here. If we can learn to manage our relationship with food, and we women are good at managing, aren't we not? Maybe I should say juggling. We can apply the approach to the rest of our life, from the way we dress, because in many ways we are also what and how we dress. For the vacation we take, the people we care for, the work we do, the money we have, or we don't, and the life we lead. Because at the end of the day, it's about managing a recipe each of us must work on through life. It's a recipe that includes a few ingredients such as timing, location, IQ, EQ, preferences, and bien sûr, humor. Plus, add your own herbs and spices. A basic trait of the stereotypical French woman who is bien dans sa peau is One, not being static. Two, constantly fine-tuning and reinventing yourself, as well as being both realistic and proactive. Pretty good recipes, isn't it? Well, in French, we call such a woman une battante, a fighter. I have a couple of questions for you. I don't know how bien dans sa peau she really is, but do you know what Martha Stewart was doing at age 30? Meg Whitman at 30? Suze Orman at 30? I'll save the answers, but I will tell you that at age 30, I was an account executive at a small PR firm in New York City. How I got there, and from there to a corner office, and then to my third act as an author, is a bit of what I will share with you, but more important are some of the transferable lessons and some advice I learned along the way. Like so many business veterans, I wish I knew on the way up what I know now. I wish I knew a dozen or so common sense ideas early in my career and had a sage mentor to share them and make them come alive for me in today's business world. No such luck. I learned by the sink or swim method. In 1975, Time magazine declared we were entering the year of women. I'd say they printed that story at least a quarter century too soon. Sure, we women like me were maturing then with a sense of identity and opportunity and entering new fields, but the tangible results were a generation away and just not in the corner offices or the boardrooms. For the past decades, though, in the U.S., far more women in the 18-24 age group have attended college than ever before, and women now make up a majority of college students over men. In developed countries as well as in developing countries, the future belongs to the emerging class of female professionals. So, while we all recognize the landscape for women in business is changing, albeit slowly, I am still troubled by the lack of coaching, mentoring, and role models, and that's a sweeping concern, an impediment to growth, status, and even innovation. It seems to me that even though the demographics are changing fast, we are relatively stuck in a mostly old business culture and a man's world. When women will rule the world, and they will, they'll need to reinvent the rules. For sure, no more meeting at 7:30 p.m. Someone recognized himself there. Meanwhile, an equally sweeping and emerging women's issue is achieving a healthy balance of work life with life. Not so easy amid the pressures of personal responsibilities, the need for sustaining gratifications, and the seemingly ever-increasing complex set of business challenges, expectations, and pressures. Finding one's equilibrium has been a major theme in my writings. Do I repeat the word mentoring? I dare so. Excusez-moi. Speaking to an audience of 2,500 women in a Boston ballroom at what was billed as a premier leadership conference for women in business, I said, "So, here's a question for you. Excluding family members and not counting peers you go to for routine help, do you have a senior person in business who consistently offers you sound counsel and support and who champions you? In short, is there a person you've had or have with your mentor? Raise your hand if you have someone." Perhaps 15% of the women raised their hands. Okay, new question. Raise your hand if you like chocolate. Easily, 80% of the women shut up hands. Scientific? No. Telling? Yes. Women may share a lot of things, like a love for chocolate, but having a strong mentor is not one of them. Now, just imagine for a second if women liked mentoring as much as chocolate. What a world it would be. Sure, there are some successful women today who reach a hand back to pull people ahead, but the simple fact that we draw attention to it shows it is not a standard practice. There are communities of women online who can perhaps help in giving advice, but are a bit lean on experience, expertise, or even time. In short, you can probably find advice, the advice you want. Every flavor is available. But that's not how you learn and grow. A second or third medical opinion is a good thing, but you reach the point where you have to listen to what the experts are saying and follow the advice of one, maybe two, but not 10. I hope you have that person, and I hope you can help me paint a better picture. I confess I had a charmed business life. Not that I haven't been screamed at by drug-addicted megalomaniacs, well, one, or tolerated awkward colleagues with reptile IQs yet soaring egos, well, a few. But I've been at the table during a strikingly transitional period for women in business and have experienced a meal of small, medium, and large business in private and public versions. Even a little government bureaucracy thrown in. Well, I was born French. A sense of humor was and is essential, as is making some of your own luck. As a teenager, I discovered a passion for languages. And when we're good at something, aren't we proud and motivated to pursue it and encouraged by others to do so? Sure. Meritocracy and a quirk of chance, universal keys to business, to success, sorry, brought me to the first transformational event in my life. I became a high school exchange student outside Boston. Terrific experience, except you remember, I got fat. Wow, you can't have it all after all. When I returned to France, my horizons had broadened from wanting to go to a local university and become a school teacher, an English school teacher, to wishing to study at a top university in Paris and become a translator, interpreter, at what I envisioned as some vital crossroads of public policy, diplomacy, and commerce, such as the Council of Europe or the United Nations, the seeming pinnacles of the profession. Ah, youth. My first job after college was indeed as a translator-interpreter and small projects manager in the Paris office of a Swedish company, which ended abruptly when the office was closed during one of those periodic tough economic times that leads to downsizing. I had worked there more than a year and was given a bit of severance pay, quite a bonanza for a girl in her 20s, and it got better. I needed a job, of course, and that led me to set my sights on the Council of Europe, which for young, innocent me was, as I told you, that ultimate employer on my radar screen. So I took and aced the qualifying exam and was offered a position as a translator-interpreter starting the next session in the fall. in Strasbourg, France. So, in the meantime, I used my severance pay to travel to America and Greece, and on the spur of the moment, I took a last-minute discounted American Express weekend to Istanbul. There, on a bus from the airport to the hotel, chance or fate intervened when a handsome fellow with longish curly hair, blue eyes, and a deep tan said to me in French, "Vous êtes très intelligente de voyager avec un petit sac. You're very smart to travel so light." I always travel light. But in this case, it was because I'd left my suitcase back in Athens. I figured he was Turkish. He was not. He was an American from New York who had seen the same discounted trip from Athens to Istanbul. He became my companion for the next few days, and then for another few days back in Athens, and then for another few days, and then I was hopelessly in love. We wanted to continue our relationship, but remember, I had to go back to France to my dream job, and he had to return to America where he was completing his PhD. For the next few weeks, I faced what turned out to be the most important decision in my life, a classic. The job, the man, the city, the country. Familiar with it? The country, the city, the man, the job or the man or the job. Forget all my previous planning and dreaming. I chose the man in New York. I never took up my early dream of working at the Council of Europe. So much for planning in business and life. Lesson learned. Things happen. Opportunities are often unpredictable. Of course, I had to break the news to my parents. It was then that my mother taught me my prime management principle, and it is a wonder to me how she came to embrace it in the first place, living a simple life in rural France. Though I suppose living a stint in occupied France during World War II had its impact. She said, "Don't let fear be a barrier to achieving your ambitions." Too often, we become paralyzed, especially we women become paralyzed by worry over the worst things that can happen. We lack confidence, self-esteem, security. We panic over financial risk. We get locked into careers and lifestyles that are not what we dream for ourselves or what we can achieve for ourselves. Our passions get displaced and we're saddened and even depressed. All because we were afraid to take a risk at a moment of opportunity. Of course, there are risks that prove too risky, and those are some of our best conclusions, but they shouldn't be made through fear, but reasoning. At a recent talk 2 weeks ago at the London Business School, I heard a renowned female financial analyst who said, "I don't think Lehman sisters would have taken the same risks as Lehman brothers." Food for thought. My mother taught me that at those times of opportunity, risk, and decision, to ask myself, what's the worst thing that can happen? It has become my mantra and always served me well. When I hesitated to move to America, certainly a decision that was painful for her, she asked out loud, "What's the worst thing that could happen?" "You come back," she answered. "We'll be here for you." Once arrived in America, I worked in the proverbial fields, then was hired by a New York PR advertising firm where I leveraged my French heritage, my true passion for food, wine, travel, and comparative culture, and a bit of knowledge to become eventually the director of the Champagne Bureau, a trade organization promoting the entire champagne industry. Thanks to my position, I met all the heads of the major champagne houses imported in the U.S., And most of the major ones tried to recruit me. Therein, a lesson in both networking and patience. One day, the ultimate came calling, the house of Veuve Clicquot, my mother's favorite champagne, and against a lot of industry advice, to the contrary. The strategy wouldn't work, the brand was too far behind, the business model was not affordable, all by people who later ate their words in overdoses. I took a leap and became the first employee in a startup venture in America. What's the worst thing that could happen, I asked myself, if I quit my good job and gamble on Champagne Veuve Clicquot? I'd be on the job market in another year or so. Not so risky after all. Not a month goes by when I don't have occasion to think of my mother's advice and ask her question. It has made all the difference. Oh, and that man from the bus? We've been married 33 years. And what about Martha Stewart at 30? She was mother of a daughter and a stockbroker. Meg Whitman, she had followed her new husband to San Francisco and worked at a consulting firm. Suze Orman, the financial guru, was just out, now we are close to here, of a seven-year waitressing career at Buttercup Bakery in Berkeley. I love that. Not only evidence that life is lived in stages, but that adolescence today ends at 30. Really. At a time when a woman's life expectancy is in the 80s, until you are at least 30s in today's world, you can change jobs and careers. Go to school, not go to school, go back to school, get a different degree, get married, not get married, get divorced, not get divorced. Whatever, you are forgiven. You are trying out life. No one could have predicted my future or the stellar futures of Martha, Meg, or Suze when they were 30. If you are in your 20s, 30s, 40s, there's a lot of life and opportunity ahead. And of course, some people say 50 or 60 is the new 40. Well, maybe for some, but there are days, once in a while, when 59 is the new 60. My rise at Veuve Clicquot and in a men's drink industry is a tale of trial and error. My trials, my errors. And of determination and envelope-pushing fortitude, but mostly of some talent, time, opportunity, especially being in the right place at the right time and seizing opportunities. That, of course, is too reductive right now to do that tale is you. What was completely off the radar and incomprehensible for me at age 30 was becoming an internationally best-selling author. You just never know. In all my books, I invite women to critically assess their circumstances, but maintain their integrity as they move forward. And I'm certainly committed to helping people live life to the fullest, and maintaining one's physical and mental balance is a unifying theme in all my books. In French Women Don't Get Fat, I explore pleasures, joie de vivre, and living comfortably in one's skin. In French Women for All Seasons, it's all about the art of living well, a secret to enjoying life and discovering pleasure is cultivating a life of ongoing experimentation, exploration, self-discovery, and enjoyment. Whether it is living through a season or life, my principle is the same. Embrace the seasons and seasonality and make savoring life a more intense experience. Women Work and the Art of Savoir-Faire is about business sense and sensibility and about the way to gain know-how, a mix of competence, experience, and knowing the right course of action, and then to act in enlightened self-interest, perhaps the ultimate know-how when it comes to work and life. It's not a selfish act, but it is about creating your own luck and opportunities, and then making the most of them. The challenge for people, though, is their lifestyle. Many people go through life on autopilot, paying little attention to their senses. They have a lifestyle of inertia and want a quick fix. No matter how busy they seem to be, they are leading a life of inertia. For me, in writing about women and business, it is essential to address lifestyle and holistic approaches to coping, succeeding, enjoying, and achieving balance in life and work. Every Saturday morning when I'm in New York, I go to the farmers market where producers from the tri-state area set up stalls. Every booth has a portable white tent-like canopy to shade the people and protect from the direct sun and certainly from the rain and even the snow. Wind can be the most prevalent element, and each of the legs of the canopy has to be tied down and anchored, often with heavily weighted bags at the feet of their legs, to prevent the protective covering from flying away. I've seen what can happen if even one or two legs are not properly secured. For some reason, the four support legs and the all-important anchors at their base remind me of what it takes to support a work-life balance. Four elements. One, good health. Two, a social network of family and friends. Three, a good employment situation. And last but not least, time, space, principles, and values for you. They work together, interacting in sometimes mysterious ways, and some stronger anchors can compensate for weaker ones, but the stress is apparent then. We've been there, haven't we? Been there, done that? Lose one of the anchors, and you're certainly twisting in the wind, out of balance. While all of the four anchors, I believe, are necessary for life-work balance, the you anchor is the one that can most easily get lost in time management strife. You have to go to work. You have to talk to your mother or partner. You have to feed yourself or your family if you have one. You even have to go to sleep at night. But you don't think you have to do what you do for yourself, whether it's take a walk, read a book, or get a manicure. That's a mistake. It took me years to recognize. At the very least, you have to make time each day to let go of judgmental thinking and live in the moment, a so-called Zen moment. Lose your self-consciousness, clear your mind, and accept the present. You can feel the stress melt away. It's your time. In almost any activity you enjoy, you can lose yourself or find yourself. Focus on it. At the minimum, schedule some regular beach time, plage de temps in French. It's a space of time for oneself to which one repairs on a daily or periodic basis to achieve that healthy balance of pleasure and life. It can be found listening to music or even doing mindless chores or even turning your cell phone and internet for a fixed period. You can let your mind fill up with anxieties and vexing stress, or with a bit of practice, you can learn to head to the beach and a release from those troubling thoughts. Find your special hobbies, your pursuits, your moments. They're healthy. Remember, I said I wish I had a dozen or so common sense ideas when I was building my career? Well, here are a few more. You heard my mother once, don't be afraid to take risks. What's the worst thing that can happen? Here's another one. Fire your boss if necessary, and hook your star to a talented and dynamic leader. She or he will take you upwards with them inside or outside your current firm and protect and nurture you as you continue to make him or her look good. Trust is something most valued in employees. If you have the rising star's trust, maintain it. It's a great insurance policy. And someday that boss will help you land on your feet comfortably wherever. First, though, you have to be able to identify and work for a star in however a large or small constellation. If that's not your current boss, hint, hint. Another one, work for a winning company. Weak or failing companies can have good employees, but would you or anyone rather hire them or someone from a highly successful company? Most often, the latter candidate wins. A good employment history opens doors. Be proud to list the places where you've worked on your resume. During the first half of your career, try to get a name brand in your profile. It's a permanent reference and is a goal you can achieve over a relatively short time. You'll have to face the sober reality of your current company and position, and if necessary, take your cues from it. Of course, perhaps this year and next, it might be enough to keep your current job. But recessions end and business goes on, is going on, and you never know when opportunity will come knocking. But you can do some knocking yourself. Here's another one. Remember, image, image, image. Cultivate your professional image. Good communication skills are key, and I have a whole chapter on that, not just a good accent. But you have to be frank, and I have to be frank. As a woman, your image is perceived as more than the quality of your reports or presentations or thinking. Your looks count. How you dress, how you're groomed, how you present yourself, and more. The harsh reality is women are judged by their looks, and men mostly are not. You don't have to be a beauty, but you have to be appropriate with your industry. In the luxury goods business, you have to live the brand. Walk into an Armani store and see who they employ. Work with who you are, or work on your image, and align it with who you want to be. Your brand matters. So start working on your own DNA. And one final idea reminder for now. You'll have to read my book to learn more. My friend, chef and TV guru Emerald likes to say, pork fat rules. But as you know, in the business world, results rule. So the key to our company's success was beating all the success metrics each year, sales, revenues, placements, image, etc. Beat the projections year after year and you get noticed and you get promoted on merit. A tip, though, is to be careful not to set yourself up for failure by promising more than what you can deliver. Set aggressive but achievable results. Our company delivered double-digit growth year after year and outperformed the market year after year. It's called sustainable growth, not so easy to achieve, but that's how you keep your job and how you keep yourself in champagne. Before I invite questions, I want to return to one statement I just made. You can't have it all or do it all. Well, there is a way. It involves managing your expectations, define your own success, and understanding that life is lived in stages. I've done a fair amount of public speaking at university, business schools, here and abroad, and in the public and private questions I receive, how can I have it all, is the underlying, generally unspoken theme. I see myself at the questioner's age, full of hope and optimism, and wanting a rich, full, professional and personal life. People want it all and want the secret recipe. Recipe for what? What is it all? If you want the corner office and a family and a big house or two, you need a wife. Do you have a husband? Will he stay at home and worry about feeding the kids and calling the repairman? If not, maybe something has to go or be deferred. Maybe kids, maybe house or bigger house, maybe husband or partner. I'm also one who believes you can have it all, but just not at the right time, at the same time. Remember, life is lived in stages. And your success is not and shouldn't be defined by others' expectation of you, not even your parents. In the end, it is you being true to yourself. You living bien en sa peau. Thank you and good luck.
I want to remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our speaker today is Mireille Guiliano, author of the bestseller French Women Don't Get Fat, who is here discussing her new book, Women Work and the Art of Savoir-Faire. We have some questions from the audience, some very good questions, in fact. Here's one that asks about your next book. It says just what you want to think about when you're promoting the current one. Your latest book is focused on issues relating to young businesswomen. I notice a fair amount of gray hair here tonight. Is there a book focusing on those of us over 65 in your future?
Well, remember,
you don't
60
know.
Is the new 40.
That's right.
I don't know yet, but it sounds like my agent. You know, I'm not finished with one book. She wants to have lunch with me to discuss the next two. And I say, give me a break. I need a sabbatical. But actually, to answer your question about the next book, it was actually written before this book or in between, because I certainly didn't think and didn't want to write a business book. Never occurred to me. And again, I have to thank American Women, because they made me write French Women Don't Get Fat. And when I was lecturing in universities following French Women Don't Get Fat, I learned about something that I, although I was living in the U.S., but I'd never gone to university in the U.S., I learned something called Freshman 15. And so I was invited to talk in many universities and try to give a hard time to the cafeteria food program. And some of the women would come to me at the end and said, well, you know, you should write about your business. You should. It would be great advice for us. And at the beginning, I didn't make too much of it. And then I went to London and Milan, and it was the same question. And I thought, well, maybe there is something I can do to share some tips. And thus the book was born. But of course, I had to finish the trilogy of The French Woman, which is a French Woman Don't Get Fat cookbook, which will come out next spring. And it's actually more than a cookbook. It has 150 recipes, because I'm pleased and gratified to see that a lot of women of all ages have actually gone into cooking because my recipes were so simple and good and taught them about how to eat well without spending, breaking the bank. But it's more than a cookbook. It's also about what I've learned the last 6 years, and I've learned a lot, mostly thanks to you, going through America and the world. And actually, it was something that I never had thought about before, that so many women are spending their life struggling with weight and with their relationship with food. And so this will be my last words in that book about how to change your relationship with food and what you can and must do.
This is kind of along that same topic. How do you believe nutrition factors into a healthy lifestyle? Assuming high-powered women are extremely busy,
how are they able to manage a healthy diet?
Yes, I have a problem with that question because, yes, we're all very busy. And there are lots of things we don't control in life, but the one thing we can control is our time. And I am amazed how women, until they write down a journal of what they do, whether it's for business or for what they eat during a day, how they can change some of those things, some of those little habits, and change them for the better. Because we are what we eat, and I don't think we're getting the responses we need fast enough from the food industry and from all the garbage out there. It's not becoming easier. In a way, it's becoming more difficult because food all over, I mean, Paris included, there are fast food, greasy places, bad, and people don't have the time and buy prepared foods. And all this is very bad for you. And yet, you can make a meal in no time. It just takes a little bit of planning. And didn't I say to you before, we are very good at planning and getting organized? And once you know it, it will be part of your schedule, and you won't even think as time. You should also, and we women are not so good about delegating, and maybe that's a strength of the French woman. You know, some women say, well, you know, my husband doesn't help, or my kids don't help. Well, you have to, quote-unquote, manipulate them to make them help you. And there is a way to do that. If some of you need it, I'll give you a few tips later on.
How do you find a mentor, if not at your current employer, and why would someone want to be a mentor?
Yes, that's my next fight, because I do think there are many women, all of us have things to offer. We all have talents. Now, I'm not saying that young women won't make mistakes. We all make mistakes. But if we can help young women avoid some of the mistakes we did, I think it would be a great help. And some women don't even realize that they could be mentors. It takes a bit of time, but it's so gratifying to try to be able to help. And so often it is so easy for us to see what a young woman doesn't see. And you'll see in my books, I just gave a few examples of the young women I've mentored. But it's the same thing all over again, you know. And it comes from not only in our culture, but in many of the countries I've visited. It's the same issue because the way we are brought up as women. We don't have self-esteem. We don't have self-confidence. And how do we get it? And when I help women, no matter what it is, if it's for an interview or for a job change or for country to go and work in Shanghai, the word that comes back over and over and over again is, I'm afraid of, I'm scared that, I fear that. And women mentors can help them. Simple question, what's the worst thing that can happen? So you don't get the job because you didn't do well at the interview, but maybe it's not you doing well. Maybe it's so many other things. So move on. Fear is a terrible word.
And maybe you could speak a little bit more about the reasons to become a mentor. I mean, what is it? Aside from the obvious that we all want to empower women, what does it give to you personally to empower, to see somebody that you've helped mentor rise through the ranks? That must be enormously satisfying.
Yeah, it's an amazing gratification. I mean, no money could pay for that. It's a lot of work, and with some, you know, it's a few hours, a few weeks, a few months. For some, it's a whole year. For some, it's a whole year, and then they're okay, and 5 years later, they come back and said, I'm ready to move. I need your help. So whatever it is, it's great gratification. I mean, you know, it's easy to say because it's usually the truth that giving gives more pleasure than receiving, and it certainly is true for me.
Here's a question about women bosses. Are they tougher on women than they are on men?
Yeah, it is a sad question because one of the things I'm learning now by speaking to audiences and talking to women is, one, as my first reading said, there are not enough mentors out there. And two, when some women have mentors, most of the time it's a man and not a woman. Nothing wrong with that. But I'm saying we're missing the boat because we need to move on. We're kind of like right now at a sort of, you know, stalling. And maybe the recession will have some good sides by making us do things that we haven't thought of doing, thinking really out of the box. Because we need to not be, you know, jealous of each other or mean to each other. It's silly. I mean, we don't have time for that. We have to help each other. So creating this community and encouraging people to mentor each other. And my young women now, you know, who are into a better career, a better job, they have to start mentoring as well. So, you know, it's so that multiplies. We need clones. they clone, we say in French. We don't have enough.
Interesting question. Is it easier to find a male mentor because an older woman might feel threatened?
Yeah, it's basically what I encounter. Threatened, I'm not sure. I'm not yet, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I'm trying to understand why do so many women, when they get to the top or close to the top, forget about the rest of us? Is it because they worked so hard and were so hard that they said, okay, now I've made it, forget it? Or is it because they don't have the time or they don't think about it or all of the above? But there's no excuse, you know. And all, I mean, I cite a few movies in my book because I did some research and I couldn't believe the number of movies where women are portrayed, you know, if they are bosses and if they are successful, it doesn't have to be a CEO, but some kind of, you know, managing position, they are perceived as bad or monsters and all that. And men are not. Hey, why not? What is this, you know? So there's a lot to resolve and change out there.
All you have to do is look at The Devil Wears Prada. I mean, just the title alone pretty much says that all. And as I watched her, I thought, she's amazing. Wow, what a woman, you know. It's like, okay, I guess my shoe is on the wrong foot. I love the culture of my current organization, except for one thing. Everyone eats at their desks and don't approve of me eating in the break room or outside. What to do? Get a new job.
Remember, be your own self and do what you have to do. And don't worry about what others think or say or do. Just do it. Just start doing it. And we're going to ban a lot of things in the office one of these days. One of them is eating at your desk. You know, it's basically you're wasting food and calories and everything, because if your brain doesn't have the 20 minutes to tell your body that you've had enough, it doesn't count, so you're wasting it all. And you're eating on autopilot, so you might as well go for a walk.
Here's a related question. What do you think of 3-hour lunches? I think I know the answer to that question.
Yummy. They're delicious. But you pay for it. I mean, there is a price to pay for it, you know. Obviously, the days where I had a 2 or 3-hour lunch, I didn't leave the office at 6. But again, it's like, you know, in the wine business, we have a saying, life is too short to drink bad wine. And I used to say, life is too short to have lunch with someone you don't want to have lunch with. And so if you do, who wouldn't want to spend 2 or 3 hours with that person? Very easy. So I don't look at my watch. I don't care. And I'll make it up later. But, you know, enjoy the moment. That's what we forget with this, you know, intense 24/7 and all the tech and all the gadget, where we think we are more productive and all that. We are not. We're fooling ourselves. We're missing the boat on all these little pleasures, all these little moments that are gone. It's now and it's fini.
Sort of more of a philosophical question, I guess, but if 60 is the new 40, what is left for those of us, for women who are beyond, I assume she means beyond that age, and still desires all of the experiences that she sees around her that others are having? Can she be in the business of living and continue to be her best self and reap some of these rewards?
Yes, definitely. Actually, in my little village in Provence, there's an 86-year-old woman who bicycles every day. and has a great time and teaches kids about certain values in life, you can do things at any time. It's up there, you know. It's an attitude. It's a way of being and a way of feeling, using your senses. And as long as you have your health or relative health, you can do a lot. And age, I know it sounds cliche, but it is just a number.
It's a writing question. What was your biggest failure as a writer? And do you have a best lesson to share?
Well, I wish you always wish what you can't do. I would love to be a novelist, but I can't. And writing for me is actually very easy because the things I write about is my life. So it's actually very, very easy. It comes out quickly. It's cathartic. And it brings me back all kinds of memories that I had forgotten, you know, when I grew up. And when I start writing, they all come back. And I have a few more that came in the cookbook, that one particularly, which is magical, and it's my answer to the magical leek soup. So there will be another great magical recipe in that book. And it was reminded to me just as I was writing the business book by a very dear friend of my daughter. Actually, she passed away a few years, but I've stayed in touch with her daughter, who came to New York and had to fit in a gown because she has a very important position, and said to me, can I stay with you? And I said, bien sûr. And my husband was in China, and she said, I have to do your Aunt Bert's breakfast. I said, what? She said, yes, because my mom used to do it all the time. And her mom used to go to my grandmother's farm during the summer. And it's a long story, that a whole chapter in that book that you'll have to read. But basically, we did it together, and she lost, 5 pounds without even missing any ingredient or any meal during the day, during the week. So there are ways to, get into a lifestyle that is healthy and not about deprivation and feel good about oneself. So you just never know. But those things just, I had forgotten about that for 30 years. I can't believe it.
I want to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Mireille Guiliano, author of the bestseller French Women Don't Get Fat, and we are discussing her new book, Women, Work, and the Art of Savoir-Faire. I have a question of my own here. You talk about how important it is to have pride in your company and to really have pride and faith in what it is that you're doing in a career. And could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, to me it's very important because we spend so many hours at work that it is essential to really enjoy what you're doing. Now, of course, I give my own example where I never wanted to be a CEO, and I just fell into it. And there were a lot of things that I didn't like about it, all the admin, the paperwork, But there were so many other gratifying parts, and I think that's true of any job. There's no perfect job where you like 100% of what you do. On the other hand, I made many women change their jobs because of what I said, so I have to be careful. Just a month ago, I said to someone that if you're not happy with your job, you should quit. And the next morning, I got an email from someone who said, I was at your reading last night. I've had this job for 8 years. I hate every minute of it, and I quit this morning. And I thought, oh, my God, this is terrible. This is not the time to quit your job in this economic downside. But you know what? 3 months later, well, not 3 weeks later, she landed something else. And totally unexpectedly, and in a totally different field, but she had some skills that fitted there. And, it is being at the right time, at the right place, at the right time. And it is really knocking at the door and making your own luck. So everything is possible.
I think one thing that comes through very loudly in your book is flexibility and being available to have those opportunities happen to you, because I think career women tend to get very stuck in their, mm-hmm. I'm going in this direction, And then you meet somebody over here who says, boy, you would be great at this. And you're like, nope, I'm not going to think about that because I'm going over here. Mm-hmm. And you speak a lot in your book about having your eyes open and just being open and flexible to those kind of spontaneous things.
Yes, because your passions change. And I think, you know, the world is changing so fast. And there will be, following the this recession, with all the things we have to do in the world for environment, for better food, for all these things, new opportunities. And, you know, we might not even think about what we could do. I mean, look at me. 5 years ago, if someone had told me, you know, to start this, and now with a website, I see every day, you know, the number of people who write and need help. So there are always places to do something. And, you know, don't we all want to, whatever we do in life, make a difference and leave this world having, being able to say, you know, I made little changes, but I made some changes. To me, that's crucial and vital, and it's probably the most gratifying part of living. So we should all go for it and look for it, because we all have something to offer.
Here's a random question, but do French women have gray hair?
Yes, but they cheat a lot. Look at me.
If you're cheating, we're both cheating, so that's okay. Let's see. I'm intrigued by your version of the principle of enlightened self-interest. Could you talk mm-hmm. a little bit more about that when it comes to business?
Yes, it's something that, you know, I learned to when I was working at Veuve Clicquot, both about developing the brand of Veuve Clicquot, because here was this great brand in Europe. People knew, you know, rich history, wonderful wine, and nobody had heard about it. And, you know, it's like that in life. Nobody is going to buy anything they've never heard about. And so we developed the brand DNA, which was not so difficult, but it was all there in the archives. And it occurred to me to make the analogy to our branding, you know, because we are all brand. We are our own brand. And do we work at it? Do we develop it? And do we know our own DNA? And as I said, many, many women don't even think about, you know, they go through life and motions, and they think they make a step, and they go 2 steps forward and 1 backward, and then they wonder. But, you know, dreams are fine. But maybe I think the thing I see in French women that, and maybe because we are 15 years behind you in terms of business, and I should say many of my French friends envy American businesswomen and your productivity and your efficiency and your organization. But the one thing where, going back and forth and living between New York and Paris the last 20 years, I see my French friends doing is putting the quality of their personal life at the very top. And if that means, you know, skipping a promotion or changing gears or doing something else, they will do it, because their personal life comes first. And I think that's an asset. And as the world becomes more complex and we have to do more and more women have to work just financially, even young people in France now find themselves really wanted to work and not having work. But if you want to work and then you want to climb the ladder or the pyramid, you have to be able to still put the quality of life way up there. Because remember that anchor. And once that one leg starts wobbling, you are you're touching danger. So don't wait until it happens. You know, be always aware of what you're doing, what your choices are, what your passions are, where you stand in life, and know that life will change anyway, and some of the things you won't be able to control. But don't agonize or don't feel frustrated about certain things, because they just happen. Actually, one of my wonderful yoga teacher who now lives in this area used to say to me, things always work out in the end. It's a good sentence to remember. Things always work out in the end. Now, sometimes the end is long to come, but patience.
You spend a fair amount of time in the book, too, talking about the sort of manners of business and physical physical language, you know, handshakes, looking people in the eye. You know, why is that important, especially for women?
Well, I'm convinced through my various job that the most important skills are communication skills. And it's not only, you know, writing a good report or doing a good presentations. It's in the way we communicate, and it creates so many, especially in the men's world, it creates so many ambiguities because we are not always aware of what we do in terms of communicating. Not only with what we say, but how we say it, our eyes, our gestures, how we behave ourselves, how we act. All these things can be interpreted in so many ways. And I learn through trials and errors with young staff. You know, I would have three persons in front of me in marketing, and I'll say, okay, we need to do that. One, two, three. And everyone understood it differently. At first, I said, well, it's probably, you know, my English is not so good, or maybe, you know, it's a bit cultural difference. No, it's the way that people learn to understand you. And it's more than the words. So be very careful. And we women are good at communications, but we need to be excellent at communications, you know. And excellence, by the way, is you know, I don't like perfectionists. They're boring. But excellence, you know, doing the best we can do. And it's nothing new in the world. I mean, Aristotle gave the definition of excellence some few thousand years ago. It's not an art. It's a habit. So I'm saying practice, practice, practice.
I'm going to tell a little secret about Marae. And it was not a big one, but a couple years ago, I think somebody that we mutually know says, her life is so perfect. And it was right after I learned that, you know, the little drawing on her book of the lady riding a bicycle with the baguette in the front. She had done this and gone head, straight over the handlebars, and you were laid up for quite a while.
I still have my scar.
Yeah. So even perfect French women that are, you know, have wonderful lives.
Fail and fall.
Boy, did she fall, too.
And don't wear helmets. Bad. Don't copy them.
In France, I don't think there is a helmet law, is there? No. See what happens in those European countries?
Backwards. Barbarians.
Let's see. Age discrimination, is it still alive and well?
Yeah, it is. And more than age. I mean, it's in Europe, you know, we don't have all these laws that you have against discrimination, harassment. I mean, they're not that clear. But I've seen it and heard it when I was in France, and it's like, well, and even coming from women saying, well, we don't want this girl. She's going to get married in a year, or, you know, she just got married, so she's going to start a family, and then, you know, that. And even if that woman was the best to get that particular job. So it's there, and that's another thing we need to make progress.
And how do we go about making progress?
That's very hard.
Being our very best selves, I guess, as we get older.
And a lot of social things. And in that sense, you know, in France, although we don't have the jobs, but women have better social help in terms of kindergarten and, you know, places for their kids and the hours and being able to take a few hours here and there to take care of their children. We need to put pressure. And, you know, it's starting there are some companies in the U.S., good companies, who are making a priority about retaining talent because they see a lot of women saying, well, if I can do that and if I can do this for my family, then, you know, the job is not worth it. And so they're trying to make those changes, but it's slow going. So we need to be strong and firm and demanding.
Unfortunately, we've pretty much reached the end of our program. I want to thank Marae Guiliano, author of the bestseller French Women Don't Get Fat, whose new book is Women, Work, and the Art of Savoir-Faire. We also want to thank our audiences both here on the radio, in television, and the internet. I'm Jane Ganahl, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
That's cool. I like that.